From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, March 22nd through Friday, March 26, 2021. It was a week highlighted by a long-anticipated and overdue Biden press conference, increasing political and humanitarian pressure on the southern border, consequential voting rights legislation going in opposite directions between Washington and Georgia, foreign policy hotspots and issues busting out all over, threatening moves by North Korea, trouble with China, and questions about the ongoing American presence in Afghanistan. Capping it off, concerns about COVID-19, vaccines, variants, and stats. Not to mention debate about gun control legislation making its way back into the center circle of our never-ending 10-ring circus. Stand by, as we're about to be joined by media thought leaders, left, right, and center, if you can tolerate such a radical radio concept, from all across America. Walter Sterling in Ohio, Dana Lesh in Texas, Bernadette Duncan in Massachusetts, Lee Habib in Mississippi, and Bobby Winston in Rio de Janeiro. Opinionated folks with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation. It's all part of the verbal stew in a deafeningly noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, climate change, the environment, and the Iceland volcano. More tornadoes have touched down in the south this week, leaving a path of death and destruction. Climate change and environmentalism continue to be hot topics of controversy as we move into the first spring of the Biden era.
The eruption of a long-dormant volcano in southwestern Iceland has drawn large crowds of visitors eager to get close to the lava flows. Fortunately, it's in a remote part of the country and does not pose a threat to life or property, but it sure is interesting and another stunning example of the power and unpredictability of Mother Nature.
At number 9, Andrew Cuomo and Gavin Newsom face pressure. Pressure being faced by the blue state governors on each coast continues to grow. Newsom still faces the prospect of a recall in California, and Cuomo faces sexual harassment charges as well as an impeachment investigation connected to his nursing home death rate cover-up scandal in the Empire State.
Now, there are embarrassing accusations that Governor Cuomo's administration arranged special access to government-run coronavirus testing for members of his family and other influential associates during the early days of the pandemic when testing was not widely available.
At number 8 this week, race relations and discrimination against Asians. A new Gallup poll indicates that there has been a 17-point surge to a record-high 48% among Americans in worry about white-black race relations during the past year.
Meantime, there's a significant increase in the number of hate crimes against Asians being reported across the country. In the Big Apple, the NYPD has launched an initiative to tackle the growing problem. Although there's a long history of anti-Asian prejudice in America, much of the present wave of random anger has been prompted by China's murky role in the origins and spread of COVID-19, not to mention other serious issues the U.S. faces in its increasingly strained relationship with the aggressive communist superpower. Of course, reasonable and intelligent people understand that all Chinese are not communists and all Asians are not Chinese.
At number 7 this week, U.S. foreign affairs as applied to China, Russia, North Korea, and the Middle East. In addition to ongoing problems with China and Russia, the president is now dealing with renewed aggressive missile testing on the part of North Korea.
Not to mention questions about America's continuing presence in Afghanistan and the latest on the Israeli-Palestinian struggle, issues that came up at his press conference on Thursday.
At number six, a tie between the Capitol insurrection investigation and Sidney Powell's questionable legal defense argument. The investigation into the January 6 attack on the Capitol building continues, with new information emerging every day as to its organizers, instigators, and the identities of key participants being revealed.
Former Trump attorney and conspiracy theory queen Sidney Powell is back in the news as she reveals the shaky argument she's conjured up in her defense against a $1.3 billion defamation suit being thrown at her by Dominion Voting Systems. She now says that she never expected reasonable people to accept her claims of widespread voter fraud as fact. I guess she now sees herself as a satirist.
At number five this week, voting rights legislation in Congress and in Georgia. The Democrats in Congress are pushing forward with their initiative to expand access to voting across the nation as what they describe as an antidote to voter suppression and racism, while the Republicans in Georgia have just passed sweeping reforms to limit access to voting as a measure to curtail what they claim is widespread election fraud.
Also, one of the big struggles in Congress between the Democrats and Republicans this past week has been over the question of what to do about the filibuster going forward.
At number four, the economy tied with the education crisis. As stimulus checks begin hitting bank accounts, confusion remains as to when they will arrive and how much money they will contain, depending upon individuals and families' financial circumstances.
On the education front, the drumbeat to get the schools open and kids back in the classrooms grows louder each day.
At number three this week, the border crisis and immigration reform. In spite of the coronavirus being his number one priority at the moment, immigration was the main topic of interest to reporters at the president's press conference on Thursday.
Biden assured everyone that conditions for unaccompanied minors will improve, blaming the Trump administration for the spike of migrants at the border. I suspect, however, it won't be that simple, and he's facing a long-term and highly complicated struggle. Perhaps it's time to cast aside the partisanship on this problem and begin working together to find a common workable solution.
At number two, COVID-19 vaccines, variants, prevention, and stats. Although it feels as if things are getting better, and hopefully they are, many health officials warn that we are still not out of the crisis and that the variants, as well as super spreader events, such as what took place last week at spring break in Miami Beach, could plunge us into a setback.
Concerns also continue about the efficacy and safety factors connected with the various vaccines being delivered by the leading pharmaceutical companies, such as Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, Moderna, and especially AstraZeneca. During today's show, we'll be checking in with our correspondent in Brazil, where things have spiraled out of control, and that nation is now being described as a major health hazard to the world.
At number one this week, shooting violence and gun control. The tragic gun violence in Boulder this week, on the heels of last week's mass shooting in Atlanta, have catapulted the ongoing debate over gun control legislation back into the very heart of the national conversation.
We'll be addressing this issue on today's program in an interview with one of Talk Radio's leading Second Amendment advocates that you will not want to miss. So hang on to your ears as we take a deep dive into the mind-blowing issues facing our society in the spring of 2021. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the most discussed talk media topics of the COVID era has been the education crisis prompted by the long-term closing of schools and the uncertainty of scheduling a balance between in-class and at-home learning. Joining us now is nationally syndicated talk show host Walter Sterling, whose weekly program Sterling on Sunday is carried on a network of some of the largest and most important radio stations in America. Walter, you're the father of three girls, one in college, one in high school, and one younger than that. You got a bird's eye view of the COVID crisis as it's affecting education.
I don't have the luxury of theory. I don't have the luxury of a meta view of the situation. Mine is a hardcore, day-to-day, dealing with the schools and dealing with my children's point of view. Experienced it this morning, experienced it last night. Starting with the 18-year-old who's at Syracuse University. At the moment, Michael, she is confined to a hotel room near the campus because she's in quarantine again. Now, they test her every 2 days, and she's always been negative, but somebody down the hall of her dorm tested positive. Therefore, they have to quarantine the whole floor. And in her case, they're putting her in a hotel room near the campus. What does that mean? It means that for 10 days, she can't leave the room. Let me repeat. For 10 days, she's confined to the room. She is a prisoner in a hotel room. Can she get packages? No. Can she see friends? No.
What kind of education is going on? Is she doing learning, or is she just sitting in the room, not plugged into any kind of educational system?
Since the beginning of school, she's gone to school online while sitting in a room in a dorm. She could do that at home. But if she does that at home, she loses her scholarships. And if she leaves, get this, this is the best part. If she leaves that hotel room today to walk down the hall, she gets suspended.
What is the psychological impact of this on her?
Great question. As every freshman has, she had some anxiety issues at the beginning of the year, some ADHD issues, and she was really getting better. She was fine a week ago. She was totally focused, doing well, getting her work done. And every day she's in that hotel room, she looks more miserable and approaching panic attacks. It has a profound negative psychological impact on her for reasons I don't quite get, because, wait a minute, every administrator in that school is in contact with people who are positive at random times. Are they confined to a room for 10 days? I have to do everything I can to not call. My wife has forbidden me to call and say, what are you doing?
Well, you know, it's like fighting City Hall. I mean, this is going on around the country, and it really ties into a separate problem that connects to this, of course, during COVID, and that is the whole nature of the way colleges and universities operate in terms of fundraising, in terms of what you got to do to have the scholarship, and in terms of what the dorm system really means.
Then the 15-year-old was straight A's last year because she decided in ninth grade to be straight A's. She focused and put her big brain to work, and son of a gun, she had straight A's last year. This year, what she had in-home learning. She had to start the year until like a month ago doing her classes online. Immediately, she couldn't focus. She was distracted. She didn't know how to learn online. It's a different way to learn. There are kids who excel at that. There are kids who do lousy in a classroom, but boy, you put them on a computer alone and they'll do great. She's not one of those kids. She needs a teacher to say, pay attention. Well, no one's been saying pay attention to her. And she has three F's all of a sudden. Now she has three F's. She goes to school 2 or 3 days a week. She stays home 2 or 3 days a week. That's a huge shift in how you consume information, how you deal with your teachers. I was shocked to learn, you know, when they have this romantic notion of, well, the kids are learning online, the kids are learning online. I found it an amazing thing yesterday. The biggest problem, I don't hear this on the serious guy talk shows. The biggest problem the teachers have with teaching kids online, do you know what it is?
Now what?
Kids keep their cameras off. They can't see the kids.
Yeah, I've heard that. Why don't they just make it a rule that they have to see the kids? At least it creates a little more of a connection that has a big impact.
I don't know. That was my first reaction. It was like, tell the kids they have to turn their cameras on.
Right.
I'm sure I'll hear all sorts of administrative Board of Ed problems with that, or the rights of children. But yes, I'm like, you're kidding me. That's a problem?
I think you're right. I think it comes down to it's invasion of their home privacy. There have been, which of course, yeah, I know. Oh, that's crazy. Goodness.
Then with my 8-year-old, same thing. She spent the first half of the year online. Disaster. The kid's happy to be distracted by an ant on the table. That's it for the day. But the going to school, she does well. She's doing very well in school now. But those are two different educational experiences. Mm-hmm. The overarching issue is this. This system was broken before any of this started because it was invented in 1880.
I agree.
Our public school system was created in 1880 for an agricultural and industrial society. It was not invented for a thought society. It was not invented for people who work at ad agencies. It was invented to keep kids in school for 8 hours a day so mom and dad could go to the factory and the farm. There isn't one shred of evidence, not one piece of research that was done at that time that said, yeah, kids need to be in school 8 hours a day for 12 years or else they'll come out stupid. Nonsense.
That's Walter Sterling, host of the mega successful Sterling on Sunday show, heard on a network of some of the largest and most important radio stations in America. Coming up next, one of the fastest rising stars in talk radio and one of America's leading defenders of the Second Amendment, Dana Loesch. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career: Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. The mass murders committed by deranged gunmen in Atlanta and Boulder these past 2 weeks have brought the issues of firearms violence and a renewed call for gun control by Democrats in Congress to the front burner of talk media conversation. It was this week's number one topic. Joining us now is one of the nation's most outspoken advocates of the Second Amendment and gun ownership rights. She's also a best-selling author and highest-ranking female news talk radio host tracked by Talkers Magazine. Here's a fascinating excerpt of my podcast dialogue this week with Dana Loesch.
One of the observations that I've had is here we live in this era of information where I don't think at any point in American or human history have we ever been able to access so much information so quickly, all literally at our fingertips. And yet, on some issues, we have people that remain unaware of a lot of the information that's out there. And just today on my broadcast, we were playing some cuts of some of these lawmakers opining on some of these issues. And they're tough issues because they're issues that people feel very, and for good reason, they feel they're very, very passionate about it. And I think everybody comes to a particular point where it concerns firearm usage and things like that. They have their own story, or it's just something that they've experienced, or so on and so forth. That's where they fall on that line. And I've always been very, very transparent with my audience. And I'm passionate about a number of different issues, but the Second Amendment obviously is the one that I'm most known for being the most passionate about, it seems. But, and I tell people very forthright, and I've talked about this in my books, I didn't come to that position by way of, seeking an advantage or anything else. I mean, I've unfortunately been in a position where I've had to depend on something like that, a firearm, as the ultimate equalizer to make sure that I'm protected. And just a couple of years ago, we had someone who did not agree with me politically who flew to my neighborhood, flew to my state, actually got on a plane and flew to Texas and tried to break into my house.
Oh, my.
Thankfully, I was not home because it would have been a very different story. And it recalled to mind kind of the same feeling that I had when I was younger growing up, and we had an issue where and I wrote about this in Hands Off My Gun, where my family was protecting a member of my family. My grandfather was protecting the family with a firearm. And so I have a a very personal approach, and that's why I've come to that position. Now, you know, I completely respect that and accept that not everyone feels that way. Obviously, everybody comes to their own decision on these issues. But for me, this explains why I'm so passionate about it, because I was made to feel a certain way, and I felt empowered knowing that I had a means of making the situation equal, and that made me feel as though I was more protected, and that's why I have such a passion about that issue, and I take it incredibly seriously, and I, you know, I think it should be responsibly discussed. Out of all the issues, I'm like, that's the issue that I don't feel that I should be as bombastic about, because I do want people to understand that it's, you know, it's not because of a lobby or anything like that. It's because I, you know, I felt really feared for my safety, and I never want anybody to ever have that feeling. And so it's that passion that drives that advocacy. But in terms of, you know, when you have these news stories like this, they're awful. And I want to make sure that those out there, regardless of whether they agree with me or not, that they just know what the law is and they know what the facts are. And I will give them that. And if they still want to disagree because that's just not where they fall down on the line, that's fine. I mean, I wouldn't be a conservative if I didn't believe in conserving individual thought, even if the thought was opposite mine. So that's how I always approach that issue. And it can be tough, very much so, as you know.
Mm. You brought up something again that you keep bringing up things that are provocative and open the door to further discussion. You talked about a person's political position being based upon their own personal experience. And sometimes we don't tend to realize that we should look at somebody's point of view from the position of what it's like to be in their shoes, not just with guns, with money, with race, with all the way around, you know, the entire spectrum of issues and concerns in the human race. Is that, you know,
right?
Yeah, okay, I could see where somebody who might have been the victim of a maniac coming to kill her at her home might think that maybe it would be safe to have a gun under the pillow, or, you know, I'm talking figuratively. I'm sure you would be. And I know, I'm saying this for those that don't know you, not that I am a big expert on you, but I know you enough to know that you are that with your zeal for the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms comes the obligation to do so responsibly. I mean, you probably frown upon irresponsible gun ownership because it only undermines the positive reasons and the cause that you believe in. Am I correct?
Correct. Yes.
So
very much so.
All right.
Very much so. That's why we as
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's why, and that's one of the things that I, you know, that I've talked about before, and I've been very open and teaching, you know, responsible handling and usage and demystifying this inanimate object. So my kids were not, well, what does this do? And, you know, and I spoke to them very frankly. I'm like, look, this means that, you know, if you, you know, when you squeeze this trigger, there's no backspace. There's no delete. There's no undo. You don't, this isn't digital. This is real. This is meat space, so to speak. So you have to, you know, and I put it in terms that they could understand, to where it was sobering, but not terrifying, but it demystified it. So yes, to your point, absolutely. I do agree with you.
In conclusion, and certainly only because we're running out of time, not because we're running out of topic. You mentioned you're a conservative. You are a conservative, and you do radio. And we've discussed how much has to come to the microphone every time you go on the air. And the world is getting more and more complex. And these are very, very stressful times. That being said, what's your view of the, I see it as a fork in the road right now for the conservative movement in America, and specifically for the Republican Party, and for the role of Donald Trump within the mix of conversation. You've got to be thinking about this just in terms of positioning your own strategies and your own thoughts. As a leading conservative radio talk show host and thought leader, what do you think we are facing now in terms of the next steps in the evolution of the conservative movement and the evolution of the Republican Party?
No, I think that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think that the past 4 years, and even leading up to that, I would even include some of the germination coming from the Tea Party movement on this. I think Republicans got the big tent that they always talked about. Now they don't know what to do with it. They got a coalition and now they don't know what to do with it. And you have some people who are in decision-making positions that think it should go one way, and that's the old school way. And then you have others that are like, no, this is a new era. It's a new era culturally, with technology, and even the way that people are in going out and politically evangelizing, I guess you could say, that things have to change, and this is the coalition that they have. I think that it's fantastic. I always go back to what Reagan said, that my 80% friend is not my 20% enemy. And I think if Republicans want to be successful, that should be their mantra right now, because they have a once in a lifetime opportunity to really maximize this gift that has been given them, just because they, for the most part, have been, you know, in limited government. And I think if they can make that work, they could be setting up the party for success for not just years to come, but for generations to come. So there's a lot of careful steps to make, and I hope they don't lose sight of that. But I think it's an exciting time to be a conservative. Honestly, I think it's an exciting time for Republicans, so long as they can be happy warriors and they know how to use it.
Where do you see Trump in all of this?
I see Trump kind of as the populist litmus test. He's sort of a measure. And I think that he's not a politician, really. He's not a perfect candidate. I know one of my favorite things to say is, but his tweets, you know, whenever I see bad policy come up, I go, well, at least we don't have any mean tweets anymore. Right. I mean, we're going to have a ton of tax cuts and, you know, who knows what's going to happen with regulation and Section 230 and all this other stuff. But hey, at least we don't have those mean tweets anymore. Am I right? I just think that we need to keep things in perspective, because if the measure is going to be mean tweets, well, at least some people have the respect for others to keep all their freak flag out and flying in the public instead of hiding it and pretending that secrecy makes it a virtue. So I think that he's going to remain kind of the standard bearer for the level of populism that is within the GOP. And I like populism too much, and it's like salt. You can oversalt the dish. You can have too much populism, but a little bit can be a good thing.
That's Dana Loesch, the nation's leading female news talk radio host, heard daily on Radio America. The conversation you just heard is an excerpt from this week's installment of my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview. You can hear the entire conversation at mhinterview.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. President Joe Biden finally gave his long-awaited first formal press conference this week, answering tough questions during a White House briefing on Thursday afternoon. Much of the buzz leading up to this event focused on Biden's demeanor. Could he answer unexpected questions off the cuff? Would he lose track of himself, commit a gaffe, forget a name, fly off the handle, feed into the narrative that he's getting old and cognitively impaired? Well, none of that really happened. He got through it in fine fashion, at least in regard to those concerns. Obviously, not everyone is in agreement with the policies he outlined at the conference, but those are different issues than the nagging question, why has he been hiding from the press? Bernadette Duncan is a former longtime talk radio producer and author of the talker's book, Yappy Days, in which she recalls working with Biden back during the 2007 presidential primary, and that he was difficult to rein in once he started yapping.
The fact that he invited me to call him Joe basically told me everything I needed to know about this guy. He wanted to sound, appear, interact as a friendly guy.
Which I guess was part of his long-windedness.
That's right. The joke behind the scenes was that if you ask him what time it is, he'll tell you the history of the clock. And I had one incident with him, and only one, because the incident was that he was passing the 10 minutes of the promised interview, and he kept going and going and going, so that I had to bump the next station, the next interview. And the reason might be because he was telling his story, as politicians do, about certain pivotal moments in their lives. And in this case, it was the unfortunate death of his wife and a one-year-old child. Let's just say that it's very awkward as a producer to interrupt somebody who is a potential president,
mm-hmm. Current vice president.
Right. And say, excuse me, sir, but...
Excuse me, Sir Joe.
Right. But the problem was that I did interrupt. I would click into his ear. I would say, you got to go. I would be talking into his ear. And it's as if he was on some sort of hypnotic state. So much so that I ended up having to call into his campaign manager, who was sitting outside Joe's office, and I said, please, I am begging you, please break down the door, go in, and tell him to get off the phone. Mm-hmm. And we regrouped. I got totally back on my hinges, as did he, and we picked it up again. But I got to tell you, this is... let's just put it this way. The cock is my boss, mm-hmm. and I have to be precise with my radio hosts.
Well, did you ever have a discussion with him directly about this problem, or was it always through his handlers?
I would have a discussion with him, but apparently he did not have a cock in his head, so much so I discovered quickly. So I started to lie to him about, okay, this station only wants 8 minutes. Giving him 2 extra minutes to wind down the interview, or I even got to the point where I was asking him, just do this one for 6 minutes, when it really was a 10-minute interview.
Did that have an impact on him, or did it still come down to hairy, stressful endings?
Very hairy, very stressful, and sometimes non-endings.
And what did his handler say about this situation in his defense when you were complaining to them?
This particular fellow said to me, now you know why he loves you radio people. The leash is longer than on television.
Which is true. TV is, you know, very, very draconian about it. And that's why it's always fun to watch when you're watching the CNN and the Fox people doing their interviews. And those of us in radio and television can sense when they want to end it and the person starts another thought and it's an important person. You can see the face of the host like, you know, and it's a very common situation. That's former talk radio producer Bernadette Duncan, author of Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, not to mention the wife of the host of this program. Coming up next, a conversation with talk radio's leading storyteller discussing the crisis at the border and immigration reform in America. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Attention homeowners, spending more time around your house means you're putting more stress on major appliances that keep your home running. Like many Americans, a major breakdown could be very costly during these uncertain times. AC unit goes, that's $4,500. Water heater breaks, $1,500. When you own a home, it's always something. If you have a home warranty, those repairs could cost you nothing. A Home Service Club warranty pays for the repair or replacement of your home appliances and systems when they break down, even from normal wear and tear. For about $1 a day, you can cover your home appliances and systems. It's not a question of if they'll break down, it's when. If you call now, you'll get your first month free and $75 off your first year. Make home appliance repairs one less thing to worry about. Call 800-259-1604 now for your free quote, free first month, and $75 off your first year. 800-259-1604 now. That's 800-259-1604. Again, 800-259-1604.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. The immigration crisis along America's southern border has reached an alarming level, and it's presenting the Biden administration with an extraordinary headache. We turn now to one of America's greatest storytellers. He's the host and producer of the nationally syndicated two-hour daily program titled Our American Stories, which is heard during the evenings on stations large and small coast to coast. His name is Lee
Habib. He's the half-Italian, half-Lebanese child of immigrant grandparents and raised as a Christian. What are your thoughts about what's happening in terms of that current issue?
Look, you know, we've always had issues. Our show doesn't deal with illegal immigration.
I want to just point out that I'm aware of that. I'm asking you the question more of you personally, because you are a thinker, you are involved in these things, you bring great intelligence to the airwaves. So I'm giving you an opportunity to sound off on something on my show, not necessarily
sure.
on yours.
Well, you know, I would only speak for my grandparents. They both waited many, many years to come here legally. My grandfather used to have very harsh words for Italians who came here illegally. Very harsh. He didn't like them. Now, he liked them personally, but he didn't like what they did, because he said they cheated. They cut to the front of the line. We decide who comes here, Michael. That's for us to do. It's not fair to all the immigrants around the world who have reasons to come here, want to come here, and are waiting in line, paying the price, taking the test. Remember, I told you there's a test, and then there's an oath of allegiance. This is what creates the assimilation that we need. So our show is an unbridled enthusiast for immigrants. We think that without immigrants, America is not America, that it's a part of our heritage. But that immigrant groups around this country, lots of Latinos don't like illegal immigration, particularly the roofers in southern Arizona, right? Because they're getting a legitimate wage, and then their wage is going to get undercut by free labor or cheaper labor that's off the books. By the way, the Republicans and the Democrats both have plenty of blame on both sides for illegal immigration. But we're here to talk about, in our show, legal immigration, because we think it's what differentiates us from everybody else. Let's put it this way. We have an executive producer from China, and he likes to tell young people in America why his family left China, that his father was a top doctor making $137 a month, because that was his wage set by the Communist Party. His father was not allowed to be a critic of the party. If he said anything against the Communist Party, this would not bode well for his career or his family. They got out. The whole family got out. And Stan loves to tell people about the blessings of this country and what it was like to live in this, quote, miracle China. It wasn't so lovely that you couldn't speak, that the internet was guided and watched mercilessly by apparatchiks and neighbors, people ratting out fellow neighbors. There's no free speech in China. There are Muslims being indoctrinated in camps. China's a real, but yet there are great Chinese people. So when we talk about China, we love to talk about our Chinese immigrants, but we don't talk a lot about China, the Communist Party, except through the voices of our Chinese immigrants who talk about what life was like in China and why they escaped it, what life was like in Cuba and why they escaped it, what life was like in Venezuela, why they escaped it, or why they're coming from places like El Salvador or Yucatan. Why? Why did my grandfather come from Italy? A guy named Mussolini is why my grandfather came to Italy. Why did my Lebanese grandparents come? Well, they were seeing ethnic strife between religions, and it worried them. It worried my grandfather what was going to happen, mostly between Muslims, the Shia-Sunni debate and discussion inside Islam, and particularly the radicals, very small percentage of radicals. And they're a very small percentage of Muslims. Most Muslims are peaceful, but they're a small radical percentage. My grandfather was telling me about back in the day. And so, you know, our position is that we love immigrants. Our position is that immigrants all have the same story. They're leaving behind everything they knew, coming to a country with a new language, and coming to a new country where by the next generation, they're hoping their kids can assimilate, that they can speak English, that they can have more opportunities, they can practice their religion freely, they can practice their business freely and unencumbered. This is a beautiful love letter to America, the fact that people want to come here. And it's an even more beautiful love letter that we adopt them. And we've been adopting the other forever here in this country. And yes, it's a rough patch to come here as a Lebanese person or as an Italian, WAP, Dago, Guinea, you name it. Jews faced all kinds of discrimination. But it didn't stop Jews from doing well in this country. In other words, whatever racism they experienced, Jews triumphed over that racism in America. It wasn't so systemic that Jews couldn't do well. It wasn't so systemic to my Lebanese fairgoers that we didn't do well. Indian Americans, there may be some people making jokes about people from India, but Indian Americans are the richest Americans in the country now, highest per capita income Only three generations here and Indian Americans can teach us all about how Americans view dark-skinned people. America is not. This is the one thing we say over and over again. It's just not a white supremacist nation. This is a lie that all white people are racist. I'm not white. But it is such a virulent lie because in my experience and in the experience of most of our storytellers, most of them tell the story about how white people went out of their way to help. Of course, there were some white people who didn't like you because of your ethnic heritage. There are Japanese who don't like Chinese. There are Northern Italians who don't like Southern Italians. There are Catholics who don't like Protestants. And there are Protestants who don't like each other. But there's always been ethnic and religious strife in the world. Our position is that right now, walk around, your eyes don't lie. There's never been less of it in America than ever before than right now. And we believe even some of it may be manufactured. Because the hate level in this country is, I believe, it levels I can't even imagine. As an Arab, I've lived here all my life with an Arabic last name like Habib. And even after 9/11, where everybody said ethnic hatred is up against Arabs, I went to all my Arabs and I said, Arab friends, I said, have you experienced ethnic hatred? No. Have you experienced ethnic hatred? No. Who are these people they're talking about? Yeah, I got stopped a few times by TSA because they were profiling. And I didn't like it. But if that's the worst thing that happens to me on a day, and it happened once a year, then this is not worthy of my time. Because the overwhelming amount of my experience, massive overwhelming part, is white people actually bending over backwards to ask me if I'm comfortable, ask me about my faith, ask me about my people and where we came from. And, you know, I had my Italian grandparents and Lebanese grandparents didn't want their kids to marry each other. And they did anyway. And then I watched my Lebanese grandparents and my Italian grandparents bounce their Lebanese-Italian grandbabies on their knees. And in one generation, they stopped that inter-ethnic slight. And we've seen this throughout American history. One generation after the generation that comes here, the assimilation begins, the intermarriage begins, the love begins. And this is an incredible love story, America. And yes, there are problems. And yes, we hear about it incessantly, forever. We constantly hear about the problems. It's about time we opened up our eyes, and this is what our show tries to do, and say, yes, there are problems, but my goodness, look around. There's beautiful, wonderful, glorious stories everywhere around you.
That's Lee Habib, the host and producer of the mega-popular syndicated series Our American Stories, heard on hundreds of leading news talk radio stations across America. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. We've got time for one more, and it is so important. Although here in America, we seem to be making progress in the battle against COVID-19, no one is really safe until the coronavirus is eradicated worldwide. And that is certainly not the case, as evidenced by the catastrophic developments unfolding in Brazil. For first-hand insights, we turn to our correspondent in Rio de Janeiro. She's an American expat living in Brazil for the past three decades and a world-renowned, award-winning artist. Her name is Bobby Winston, but she's better known to her fans as La Femme Bobé.
The COVID-19 is completely out of control. There is no organization to try to get it under control. And truthfully, yes, Brazil has become a hazard for the rest of the world. And they know it here. They know it. They feel very guilty. But we do have a couple of years left with this federal government. And I would anticipate that during the next couple of years, nothing much is going to change. Vaccine turnout, rollout is very scarce and very slow, and only the Chinese vaccine is being produced here in Brazil, with approximately 1 million doses maybe per month coming out. And that's not very much, because the variants are raging like a wildfire. And I don't believe it can keep up with the rage of the fire. So I don't have too much hope for this to be put under control.
Oh, my goodness. Now, what is the attitude toward the Chinese vaccine in terms of the local medical authorities and conversation in the media? Is there confidence, at least in the vaccine, or is there a lack of confidence among Brazilians and the doctors in terms of the Chinese vaccine? We don't hear that much about Chinese vaccines in the United States.
Well, Brazil has had a fairly good economic relationship with China over the past, I would say, past decade. And for this reason, when China offers anything in the way of business, Brazilians more or less adapt to it without much negative reaction. So I believe they're reacting to it in a positive way. They are talking now about the AstraZeneca, but of course, that's not been approved. But Brazil is in such a desperate position, they might take anything, including the Sputnik from Russia. I am not for any of this, and I am going to be resisting as long as possible, unless it becomes mandatory, to take these particular vaccines.
But you have been particularly cautious about going out, wearing masks, who you're with. So you're not one of these Brazilians that we see in the news flaunting all caution and partying and having festivals and carnival. And, you know, the image that we have of Brazilians is that it's not that different than I'm sure the images you saw recently in Miami Beach of young people for spring break, just wall-to-wall people. And of course, they had to bring in the police, and there was even rioting there. So I know the answer to the question is you've been very careful because I've been talking to you. But you said something a moment ago that's very interesting, and you said the people in Brazil are aware of the problem now. Has there been a change of attitude that that other Brazilians are being more careful? Has the government, which you say is there to stay for at least the foreseeable future, enacted any measures to keep people as safe and as distant as possible? How's that playing out?
Well, it's not playing out very well from my point of view.
Oh.
The people are split, you know, pretty much down the middle of whether they're for restrictions or want their total freedom. And so that's hard to control. On the other hand, during Carnival here, Brazilians we had a mandate of nothing. Everything was canceled. So there was no Carnival, not even block parties. And it looked to me as though that was respected very well. Last week, the beaches were closed here in Rio. And it looks to me like that is being respected very well. But on the other hand, the federal government and the president is promoting complete throw caution to the wind. He's acting as though this is just a little flu. And he's telling everybody to stop whining and crying because you can't cry forever. So it's a mixed message. And I am going to wear my mask, stay distanced, and bathe in alcohol for as long as I can. Well, I have no intentions of throwing away my mask.
That's American expat Bobby Winston, an internationally renowned artist known to her fans as La Femme Bobé, living in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And that brings us to the conclusion of this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at this past week of Monday, March 22nd through Friday, March 26, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the
inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.